The Maine Calling Book Club heads Into the Storm with August Gale. When writer Barbara Wall started doing research for August Gale, her plan was to write a book about a horrific storm that took the lives of hundreds of Newfoundland fishermen in 1935. But the book took Walsh on a personal journey as well. Diving into the subject meant learning more about her grandfather, whom she never knew, and his family in Newfoundland. The result is a story about unimaginable heartache and resilience. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the Maine Calling Book Club, we discuss August Gale, a father and daughter's journey into the storm. If you've read August Gale, if you have family in Newfoundland, if you can relate to the kind of loss described in the book, please join the discussion. It's the Maine Calling Book Club. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Barbara Walsh's memoir, August Gale, tells the tale of two storms, a devastating Newfoundland hurricane, and her grandfather's decision to abandon his family. Years later, Walsh, her father, and her sisters took a journey together to try and understand what happened on both fronts. The result is a book described by the Portland Press Herald as a gripping family saga. In the studio with me for the Maine Calling Book Club to talk about August Gale, Linda Oliver. She's the head of reference at the Bangor Public Library. Ruth Eveland is the director of the Jessup Memorial Library in Bar Harbor. And John Keller, the author of Sea and Cloud, and currently works as a clam digger on the coast of Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you read August Gale? What are your thoughts? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ruth, I didn't ask you before you came on the show, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You actually did.
Okay, great. I did. That's terrific. So, you know, several things struck me and have stuck with me after reading August Gale, but a big one is just how hard life was for the people in Marystown in 1935, the hardscrabble life, the vicious poverty, and how they really didn't have a choice but to risk their lives taking to the sea in August, even though they knew full well that there was a history of these horrible killer storms in August and that they were really in an impossible situation. So I want to ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Linda, what has stuck with you as you think about this book after reading it?
I was struck as I read it that she was very successful about weaving the two strands together, which is a really difficult thing to do as an author. And on a personal level, I have Irish heritage, and it brought back some of the memories of my mother's stories. My mother's still alive, but of her childhood. And there were Flynn's and Fitzpatrick's listed as families that lived in that area. And I was thinking, well, I could have cousins up there too.
Oh, really? Yes. So Irish by way of Newfoundland as well.
I don't have family by way of Newfoundland, but there were Flynn's and Fitzpatrick's. And my mother's family came from Rhode Island, Irish. And then her father's family was in Plattsburgh.
Uh-huh.
So they had this kind of the men. I looked at the pictures and I went, man, those could be cousins. And they showed the picture of a casket with a wake. And my mother tells the story of having the casket in the parlor and the uncles out in the barn drinking.
John, what about you? What has stuck with you?
Well, I was impressed with her ability to, she started as kind of a journalistic standpoint, and her ability to kind of, when the facts ended, to continue on and enter the minds of the Newfoundlanders back then, the people of Marystown, and to really inhabit their voices. And, you know, when she'd go into the italics, and I think she did a really good job, because that was a break from the journalism, and it almost in places read like a novel to me. Mm-hmm. So she really switched to, you know, relatively creative nonfiction, I would say.
Right.
And even the scenes that there were no survivors from, and she did a really good job of inhabiting those scenes and
Taking scraps from, you know, the little scraps she had. One person saw Patty on the dory and she...
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, the moments when Patty and Tom Reed were deciding who was going to go in the dory. You know, there's nobody there to tell her what happened there. You know, she made that up. But it it read like nonfiction and fiction. I think it was a good intermingling of the two genres, even though, you know, when the facts ended, she continued, and I think that really made the book come together as a lot more than it would have been if it was just a strict journalistic standpoint.
And what about you, Ruth? What has stuck with you?
I like narrative nonfiction as a style. I know that there are people who are a little uneasy with the idea of putting narration into something that is strictly a nonfiction work, but I think particularly for a story like this, it gives it an approachability that a lot of other that a more dry presentation might not have had. I think the thing that was so I liked so much about the book, but I was 9/10 of the way through it at the point at which it's talking about Lillian and her reaction to the death of her family, and all of a sudden it struck me that my grandmother was widowed with 3 surviving children, the oldest of whom was 6, and lived in a fairly not quite hardscrabble fashion, but in what they used to refer to as genteel poverty, as a way of trying to pulling themselves along. And this was in Halton in the early 1900s. And the idea of having sometimes when you're in a book discussion, you're talking about the facts of the story and you're talking about things, and then all of a sudden there's a personal reflection that just kind of overwhelms you, or that you're having a perfectly logical discussion. All of a sudden, somebody has an emotional reaction to the book in a way that it just kind of comes out of left field. And it made me want to go back and reread the whole thing over again with that perspective in mind that I just had. I didn't think that I had that degree of personal connection with a story, and then all of a sudden I did. It was an interesting way to read the book.
And did your grandmother talk about what it meant to, in that generation, raise 3 children without a husband?
She did some, yes. She lived with us most of my life, so I had lots of opportunity to spend time with her. And it was hard. It was hard. Her sister, her older sister, came to live with them, and her sister worked in a bank and was able to provide them with some basic income. But it was a very different life than it would have been, because my grandfather was very involved in Maine politics, and it would have been a very different, they would have had a very different life,
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me when Barbara included photographs in this book, and we see Lillian's grave, and she lived 44 years after her husband died. And what it must have been like to live with that trauma and wondering if she ever really came back to being herself.
Mm. It's interesting, my grandmother kept diaries. She had started writing diaries when she was in her teens. And the year after he had been killed, he was killed in a hunting accident, and the year after he had been killed, there were no diary entries. And after about a year, she finally started writing again. But she lived another 50 years beyond that, or no more than that. And but it was still present.
Yeah,
it was still present.
Really makes you think when you walk through the old graveyards and you see death dates that are so different from one another between a husband and wife. John, as someone who spends time in the water, does the novel or the, excuse me, it's not a novel, does this book strike you as true? It's still dangerous to be a fisherman, but we have satellites and weather reports now.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
we don't hear of storms taking hundreds and hundreds of men.
No. Actually, it's interesting because I read the book last week, and I read it on a sailboat. I was out sailing my first ever solo sailing trip, and I don't really know how to sail, so I was kind of comparing what these guys are going through with, me on this sailboat with a GPS and a chart plotter and cell phone and internet, and it is a whole different ballgame because it is August, and it's these beautiful calm days just like in the book. But I knew full well that there was no gale coming in, and these guys didn't know that. And it's really impressive that it just boggles my mind that they could go out and do what they did without any forms of navigation other than a compass and a watch, really, is what they used in the fog. We're going in this direction for this amount of time, and then we got to turn. And the tide's going here.
And we learned so much about how they fish, that they went out in these dories and they would say, okay, I'm going to take 400 strokes to the east and then drop the lines. And imagining doing that when the fog sets in, as it does all the time, you know, it really is very palpable, I guess is the right word.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's strange feeling to be out in a boat in the thick fog, even when you have a radar and a GPS telling you exactly where you are and where everything else is. But to do it without any of that technology is just really impressive. I mean, the guys are doing it. You know, some of the fishermen now, you know, they grew up doing it this way, or the way that they did it in the book.
Linda, I'm struck by your head of reference, so I suspect you've had more than your share of folks coming in having you help them with genealogy. And one of the things I'm thinking about as I think about this book in particular, but just the broader move toward people learning more about their family history, why do you think we do that? Why is it important to us to know that our great uncle Patty was lost in a storm in 1935?
I think there are a couple of elements. One of them is that it's a way of building community. Is sometimes families these days don't have the cousins and the aunts and the uncles around them. So they're building a greater community in which they fit in a self-image. Some of the people that I see doing genealogy are younger, but a lot of them are maybe middle-aged or a little older. And as they get to that point in their lives, they're trying to kind of see their roots and make some get in touch with some of the elements of their past. And I think that this satisfies people in a way that is hard to do, especially if you're the last one and you don't have, nobody knows the family stories and the aunts and the uncles, that the genealogy helps bring that story to life for them.
Go ahead, John.
Maybe when we start thinking about dying ourselves too, I think we might start looking at some of our ancestors that have gone that way, and I don't know, trying to make sense of life and death. And
I think one of the things about the genealogy searching is that a lot of the times people may think of it as just finding out somebody's birth and death dates and, you know, who how many children they had and things like that. But there's an awful lot more that can be figured out about past ancestors by looking through these resources. You find out, you know, when they're looking through certain records, you can find what kind of employment they had and where they lived. And that will tell you something about the life that they had with careful research. And I think that trying to figure out from whence you came is important to people, particularly as was said, that people who don't have a lot of family stories to base it on, this is a way of fleshing that experience out. And I think it's also sometimes something that a lot of the people that we deal with are people who are looking to not just answer questions for themselves, but leave information for future generations, trying to find, you know, figuring this is something that they have the time in their lives to pull this information together. And even though maybe the children aren't interested, maybe the grandchildren will be interested, but it's a way of, I think, connecting with the future generations as well as the past. And I think that's one of the intriguing sets of conversations that we have about that.
And frequently when I've talked to people who come in to do the family stories, they say, I wish I'd listened to my aunt and written it down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, or I wish I'd gone on that trip with my, you know, my mother or my, you know, or my father to see all the places that he lived when he was growing up, because somebody is kind of the gatekeeper of the family story.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps we'll have people who have read Barbara Walsh's memoir actually take the time now to talk to that grandmother or great aunt or great grandfather about those stories and what it was like when they were kids. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mbbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about Barbara Walsh's book, August Gale, about a horrific storm in 1935 in Newfoundland. First novel I've read, or first book I've read about Newfoundland. You librarians have any recommendations for others?
I don't. I hadn't thought about that.
There is a fiction novel, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's a man who's from America who goes up with his young daughters and his aunt. And I'll have to look it up and send it to you to put on the Facebook page.
Oh, yeah, please do. Please do.
Carly Mowat's got that book, The Boat That Wouldn't Float.
Is that right? I remember that from when I was a kid. I think I read that. What about seafaring books, John? What do you recommend?
Oh, geez. I'm a big fan of The Old Man and the Sea. It's kind of old news now, but I just reread it not too long ago, and I'm just loved it. You know, I read it. You know, everybody's read it, and it's kind of cliche at this point, but I think if you read it and pay attention, it's a kind of a mind-blowing book, I think.
Did you also read that Alone on a Sailboat?
No, I didn't.
I love it. I think Barbara will love that you read her book, August Gale, while alone on a sailboat, but you did not experience any of the terror that these fishermen did.
No, nothing like that. I had a few moments, but nothing like these guys had.
Well, we're going to take
Bibles.
No Bibles. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Highland Green, a 55-plus active adult community on a 635-acre campus with nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. Hospice of Southern Maine. Calling hospice doesn't mean you're giving up. It means you're taking charge. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. And Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education capabilities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
Hi, my name is Jackie, and I am an addict.
On the next Fresh Air, Edie Falco, the star of the Showtime series Nurse Jackie. She was nominated for an Emmy this year. She won an Emmy in 2010 for Nurse Jackie and won 3 Emmys for her performance as Carmela Soprano in The Sopranos. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7. MPBN is once again pleased to be attending and to be a media sponsor of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association's Common Ground Country Fair up in Unity later in September, and we wanted to give you a heads up on a ticket offer MOFCA is running. Tickets can be purchased in advance for a significant savings. Visit mpbn.net for the details. If you plan on attending, please visit us. MPBN staff and on-air personalities will be at the fair all 3 days to meet you. We have some events planned, and we'll also have our traveling recording studio, The Booth, powered by Revision Energy, there to give you the chance to weigh in on a variety of topics and possibly find yourself on MPBN radio later in the fall. Thanks. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the monthly meeting of the Maine Calling Book Club. Today we're talking about Barbara Walsh's memoir, August Gale. With me in the studio, John Keller, author of the novel Of Sea and Cloud, Linda Oliver, head of reference at the Bangor Public Library, and Ruth Evelyn, director of the Jessup Memorial Library in Bar Harbor. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us is Ron Walsh, Barbara Walsh's father, who she writes about in this book. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, Dan. Thank you very much. I certainly would like to thank you for selecting the August Gale for your show. It's greatly appreciated. And I also would like to thank Linda, Ruth, and John for their time and effort.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, it was clearly hard for you to take this journey with your daughter, Barbara, and a lot of people wouldn't have done it. Why did you?
Well, when your daughter wants to write a book, and like you said in the beginning, the issue, she was going to write all about the storm. So I sort of got, well, so initially I didn't think I was going to be involved in it. And then she turned around and said, hey, I got to complete the whole cycle here. And the result of which, you know, was very good for me. First of all, as you know in the book, I kept it within myself for all those years, which, by the way, was wrong. And so it helped me to get to let it out, if you will. And it helped me to meet my, I'll tell you, I'm so proud of my heritage in Newfoundland. It's unbelievable. And also meeting my second family, you know, my stepbrothers and sisters. So Barbara, the funny thing about Barbara, she says, oh, she'd send me some of the chapters on the book, right? She'd send me chapter 1, chapter 3, chapter 5. I say, Barbara, where's the other ones? Oh, don't worry about them.
Well, she was playing a trick on you.
Well, she didn't want to. I think what she was, she didn't want to hear any negative feedback about it, I guess. And when she finished the book and sent it to me, she was all pins and needles about it. And I sat down and I read it in about 4 hours. She had one of my other daughters calling me, how's he taking it? You know, that kind of stuff. And I said, hey, I think it's excellent, you know, and again, it was good for me, and I think good for my daughters and my wife, because my wife really didn't know a lot neither. So,
I think some of our panelists have questions for you.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I was struck by how much you supported your daughter in her writing, and that you noticed by the age of 10 that she had a gift and a talent. And what you decided to do or how you nurtured her as a writer?
Well, you know, it's as a parent of 6 children, you're always looking for that thing that can tell you what they may be successful in. And with Barbara, it was pretty easy. At the age 10, she could tell that she liked to write. And, I always tell people I had nothing to do with the Pulitzer Prize because I can't write my name in the dirt with a stick, right? So I was really encouraged about that. So, you know, you keep complimenting them and sort of leading them or maybe pushing them a little bit. But with her, you didn't have to. She just loved to write. And she went, that was her intent all her life. She started the local the newspaper at a high school. And she did it on her own. Let's put it that way. There was very little guiding because it was easy. She knew what she wanted to do at a very early age. So we were blessed, my wife and I.
Do any of you all have questions?
I don't have a question so much as something I thought I'd say to Ron. I was interested in that this whole book, at first I looked at it like these two parallel storms, and the obvious, the gale, and then the storm of the family. But the more I thought about it, it seemed like the book was all about these connections and how these certain events affected people and how they kind of transcended the generations. And what struck me, I was actually thinking about on the way down here today, was that the book now itself has become another part of that connection, and it's added itself to this list. You know, there's the hurricane, and there's your father, and then there's you, and now there's Barbara and the book involved, and that's another connection in this whole saga. And I wondered if you looked at it like that at all, or if I'm just thinking about it too much.
I never kind of dwelled on it. I think that's a really good point. The whole family has connected, I guess. My other daughters, God love them all, and we've had conversations, and it's been good for all of us. It really has, and. Again, not to beat myself up too much, I should have opened up a long time ago, and I even made it harder for my mother, because after when we came back from California, that was it. You know, at one time he was my hero. Well, that was it. I didn't want to hear his name and all that. You know, wouldn't even talk about him. But I think that made it difficult for my mother, so I regret that, even though she probably understood. I just wish I did it a different way. But also, one other thing I want to make clear. I mean, friends of mine who have read the book, they'll kid me, you had a hero. I say, baloney. My mother's the hero. I mean, when you look at what she went through, and just for the sake of her 2 sons, and my brother, by the way, is the most wonderful guy you ever want to meet in your life. But, you know, I've got a lot to be thankful for. You know, my mother, my wife, my 6 daughters, and 7 out of 8 of my grandchildren, granddaughters.
7 out of 8?
So, but I'm a, you know, people, as I look back in my lifetime, and I just turned 79, I always tell my kids this, and they look at me like I'm a little wacky. I say, hey, I'm the luckiest man in the world, as things turned out. And my mother had an awful lot to do with that. And my wife, God love her. So I'm as lucky as can be. But that, John, that's a great point. And the other thing, on one of your comments about the sea, the most interesting thing, when we went to Newfoundland, I was in the Navy, so I know a little bit about being out in the ocean, if you will. And I was all enthused about writing the book, but I said, Barbara, how the heck, you don't know anything about being out to sea, the dangers, fishing, trawlers. And she just said, I'll find out. And I want to tell you, I think she really nailed that. She drove old fishing captains crazy in Gloucester, Nova Scotia.
I know your daughter, and I'm not surprised that you said that. Ron, let me ask you this. One thing that sort of, you know, the opening scene of the book is your father having the newspaper, you know, finding the newspaper that's skidding along in the wind and the news of the storm in that newspaper. Do you think that the news of the storm traumatized your dad and contributed to his series of bad decisions? Or do you think he was already capable of doing hurtful things? After all, he had left his own mother and not contacted her.
Well, in a way, that's a great point. And by the way, the story about that, my mother told me that story when I was, I don't know how old I was. And I never thought about it. And then when Barbara asked about writing a book, I said, you know, we got a story in our family. And I right away went to that incident of him eating his lunch. But your point is, you know, I think about that, he was selfish in a way. You know, you go back to his mother, that he never wrote her all that time while he was in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that did traumatize him, because his hero was Uncle Paddy. And there was another brother, if you remember in the book, my Uncle Leo. Well, he was the exact opposite of my father. He was a family man, a church man, worked hard, and had a very successful life. And those two really didn't get along because of that fact. My uncle Leo was always trying to tell him what he should do. And so, I don't know. I guess that was part of it. But he didn't go back to the funeral. But he did. And I think that was a money thing. I didn't think there was any way that he could go back. So,
well, before we let you go, one last question. What do you want people to come away with after reading August Gale?
Well, I guess, I think it's a very well-written story, and it tells a lot about family life and a lot about caring about your children. And to me, I always tell my children, I say, hey, blood is thicker than water. There's nothing more important than your family. So I guess that would be the major thing. And the trials and tribulations that those people in Newfoundland had to go through. Barbara often says that was their 9/11, really, when you think about it. And so, and the hard times that they had to go through. And one other thing I'd like to say, other than your question, as I've gotten involved with this thing, it is so hard to sell it, get a book moving. To me, it's, and John, I bet will appreciate this, yeah. It's name recognition and exposure. For instance, Bill O'Reilly, right? He's got the name recognition and he's got the exposure. Where John and Barbara and many, many other writers don't have that. And so you got to say to yourself, how many really good books don't make it? But anyway, Jen, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron, for calling in. And you have a lot of people nodding at your comments about how many good books don't make it. Go ahead.
I think that that's a very, very good point. And the Jessup does a lot of author programming. We have many, many authors each year. And I think one of the pleasures of it is we have a mix of fiction and nonfiction and people who are known and people who aren't known. And people coming to hear an author simply because there's an author taking the time to come to the library and present his or her work, people find that intriguing. And I think that if it's at all possible, would encourage authors who are looking for an audience to get in touch with libraries, to encourage them to try to make the effort to go to libraries, because there is a reading audience there. And I think that's a great connection.
The thing she does, she's unbelievable. But anyway, I think that's an excellent point. And I have learned a lot. John, honest to God.
Well, thank you so much, Ron, for calling in. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Madeline in Wolfsboro, New Hampshire. Hi, you're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how are you, Jennifer?
Great.
I wanted to just make the comment that this story would be very familiar to me because I'm from Nova Scotia. I have had five uncles who went to sea, and my father, one uncle, was lost at the age of 22. And it's so immediate, even in my memory, it's so immediate to know the terrors of going to sea. And they did it to raise their families. It was so dangerous. Without the equipment that they have today, as someone said in the intro, it's really remarkable. I've never been to Newfoundland, but it's high on my list. I want to go.
Well, Madeline, thank you so much for taking the time to call in. I've been struck when I visited the Maine State Museum in Augusta, and there are exhibits portraying all the different careers that people used to have. And you know, you look at those, and every single one of them was dangerous, whether you were cutting ice or in a quarry or, you know, there was no such thing as an office job 100 years ago. Madeline, thanks so much for calling in to Maine Calling and the Maine Calling Book Club today. We're discussing August Gale, Barbara Walsh's memoir about the Newfoundland Gale of 1935, which struck on August 25th, and here we are sitting on August 28th. Another thing that struck me in this book was that after the storm, when so many children were left without a father, many of the families had to place their children in orphanages, something that we don't hear about today. Is this, Inland, I'll turn it to you as a research librarian, were there other scenarios, other circumstances in which people you had to do that?
I think poverty had a lot to do with whether people had to put their children in orphanages. And when you think back, this is the time period of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And there were families all over the United States where the men would go away to seek work and may or may not make it back. And the mothers might be left with a large family, and they would try to maybe send some of the children to relatives if the relatives were rich enough, or put people, children would go to orphanages or maybe come back for a year or two. Other circumstances, and it's part of a shameful part of American history, is Native American families were broken apart and the children were sent to boarding schools that were more like orphanages, and they lost touch with their culture and their heritage. So that's another thing that I think where we see children being taken from their families.
You know, things that would just seem unthinkable today were very common.
I think that I know you're all familiar with Orphan Train, and I think that was, there were many children, a number of children who were involved in that, who had one or more parental unit who was actually physically still around, but who was unable to take care of them. And so there were children who ended up as a part of that process. It's funny, the Orphan Train, my mother was a social worker. My mother was a social worker who had graduated from social work school in 1931, and she was involved in essentially picking up the pieces after the Orphan Train stopped and how they were trying to figure out how to deal with children who had no place to go. And so there are children whose families are unable to care for them. And so the whole development of the foster family system and that whole process as a transition or as a stopgap measure, as opposed to shipping your children, you know, 1,000 miles away, it's the whole process, at least in some of these cases, they were close enough away that it could be a temporary placement and they could come back home when the parents were able to care for them again. But that's just absolutely astounding to consider.
Mm. And Orphan Train, of course, was our Maine Calling Book Club book just a couple months ago. Yeah. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Highland Green, a 55-plus active adult community on a 635-acre campus with nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com, and Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life.
On the next On Being.
Language is almost all we have left of action. For many of us, action has become what we say. The moral life is lived out in what we say more often than what we do.
poet Marie Howe on the universal drama of family and the power of words to save us. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Join us for On Being Sunday morning at 6 a.m. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Ideas from the CBC. Today's program, Once Upon a Planet. In fact and in fiction, Ideas will explore our need to know that we are not alone in the cosmos. That's Ideas coming up after Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Maine Calling Book Club discusses Barbara Walsh's memoir, August Gale. With me in the studio, Ruth Evelyn, director of the Jessup Memorial Library in Bar Harbor, John Keller, author of the novel Of Sea and Cloud, and Linda Oliver, head of reference at the Bangor Public Library. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We have a couple emails referring back to an early part of the program where we were talking about other books about Newfoundland, and I'm kicking myself because people are reminding us that that book is the other really well-known book is The Shipping News by Annie Prue, which I have read and can't believe I didn't connect, but what a fantastic book that is as well. So thank you to those who emailed in our reminder of the book that was on the tip of Linda's tongue is The Shipping News by Annie Prue. We're going to go to Joan in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Joan. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. It's actually Rochester. But I was about to speak on my grandfather, Robert Carlson, who built the old-fashioned style Novi boat out of Kittery Point, Maine, in a little barn on Tenney Hill Road. He was, before that, he was a mackerel seiner. But I also was thinking of another story that I found in my genealogy doing my hunting research for the hunting family, which my mom comes from, Hercules, or Hercules, depending on the spelling, and in the source that it might be found in, was on a boat, a ship in the 1600s where Blackbeards had boarded, and I'm going, oh my goodness, can you imagine such a thing, you know, to have someone in your family have known Blackbeard? It's quite the thing, but my father, my brother, both were lobster fishermen out of Kittery Point. My maiden name is Carlson, and they told me stories, you know, about hearing the whales sound at certain times of the year, and my father, I know for a fact, couldn't swim a stroke. He said there was no point in knowing how to swim because if you went over, that was pretty much it. We did have ship-to-shore radio back in the 50s and 60s. My mom would listen in over for Newcastle if a storm came up. She'd be worried sick about my father making it in. He fished off Duck Island and Isles of Shoal, so he was close in, but my grandfather fished much farther out. And I always enjoyed the stories, and I'm sure to look this book up.
All right.
Wonderful.
Joan, thanks for calling in. I think you'll really be able to relate to the story. Going to Mary in Washington. Hi, Mary. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer, and thank you for taking my call. I've read August Gale twice. First time I had to read it just to find out what happens, and then I had to then I could go back and thoroughly enjoy the prose and the writing style. But my comment was with Barbara's father. And how he felt about his father was a little different than how the children, the grandchildren, felt. And I think that's indicative of, you know, if it's happening to you, then that's one thing. But if it happens to someone that you hear about, it's something else. And it struck me that the father was pretty honest in how he was saying, no, the guy was a loser, and you know he shouldn't be forgiven, and it hits close to home. And I found that the way it was conveyed was really insightful of the human nature and how people are able to overcome the adversities in life. And it the book also left me wanting more. You know, I was wondering if there will ever be a sequel about the people and the families, a more in depth. Stories about how they survived and what happened to them. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. It's one of my all-time favorites. And I was just, I didn't know if the author had plans of doing anything further to research and develop some of the other people that were affected by all of this.
It is interesting to know what happened really to the psyche of the entire village and how, you know, Marystown's still there, how people did survive and did come back.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a wonderful story about human nature and how, despite all the challenges and tragedies, human nature does seem to be able to make something good out of a really bad situation.
I think that's an interesting point about wanting more from the book, and I think a lot of good books are that way, that you don't want them to end. And you know, people do ask about sequels, and a lot of times there aren't, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's, you know, it's like finishing a meal or something. You want more, but you're not totally done.
I thought one of the things that was interesting about the book is that the last third of the book, it actually went on, was dealing with loss from the sea and from the personal family stories of the Walshes. So when you read a disaster book, usually there's a small epilogue after the big disaster and you're done with. But in this case, you had a whole third of the book dealing with, you know, whether, how people dealt with loss. Some of them were, it was the end for them, that they just couldn't overcome the loss. And others of them built on and were able to do more.
You mentioned during the break, Linda, that you're a disaster book junkie. So,
I am.
What other disaster books do you recommend?
For this particular book, I would recommend Isaac Storm by Eric Larson. And he wrote, this story is about a weather observer, and this was long before the days of Jim Cantore and the Weather Center, in Galveston. And there was a hurricane there in 1900 that killed 10,000 people. And he bet that it wasn't going to happen. So there are two strands to the story. He actually lived in Galveston, what happened in Galveston. And the other part of it is kind of the birth of meteorology as we know it today. So you've got the strand of the science and of the meteorology.
Great. And we'll post that recommendation on the Maine Calling Facebook page. Mary, thanks for calling in. Headed to Jenny in Fort Kent. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Great.
Good. Look, I have a couple or a few titles from some other Newfoundland writers. I just happened to finish one by Lisa Moore, and it's called February, and it is about the Ocean Ranger, the offshore drilling rig that went down in the early 80s. So it's a disaster story, but it's a fictional account. Although the author did her homework in terms of looking at, you know, what were the contributing factors. So that was a marvelous read, and I happen to have another book by her, and by Lisa Moore. So I'll pick that up pretty quickly and start reading it. Another one is Michael Crummy, and he wrote the book Galore, which I really, really liked. And Wayne Johnson is another Newfoundland writer, and he wrote Colony of Unrequited Dreams, and that's sort of a fictional account of Joey Smallwood, who was the first premier of the province when it joined Canadian Confederation in 1949.
Well, thank you, Jenny. I've taken some notes, put those on our Facebook page,
okay.
So if anybody's not listening right now with a pen and paper, they can go there later and look. We have a couple emails. Somebody has recommended Random Passage, a 1992 novel by Newfoundland author Bernice Morgan, and then there was a sequel to that called Waiting for Time, and someone tweeted also about Wayne Johnston's Colony of Unrequited Dreams. So there's two recommendations for that book. Jenny, thanks so much for calling in, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. A funny little thing, before I read this book, I did not know what screech was. It happened to be in a liquor store last week and saw some. So I know that it really exists, and Barbara says, yes, it's called that because you want to screech when you drink it. Had you all heard of screech before this?
I had never.
Really? No. I had a bottle on my sailboat.
Did you? and would you agree?
I didn't think it was so bad.
You didn't screech there alone on the boat.
Well, not that I'm going to admit to.
These lobstermen are tough.
and something else that struck me about the book were the presence of the ghosts and the dreams.
Yeah,
and the reality that they weren't presented, almost like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel or something, as something strange or weird. It was that people had the dreams and they knew that their loved ones were gone.
I think this is not uncommon. I've heard any number of stories from friends and acquaintances about that over the years. It's never happened to me, but these are genuine experiences for the people to whom they happen.
I thought it was also a wonderful literary technique that you see in these creative nonfiction and narrative nonfiction novels, is that you would see this as a literary device also, as well as things that actually happen to people, that it adds depth to the story and what is kind of the boundary between nonfiction in a journalistic sense and creative nonfiction that brings in those elements of a novel. You also saw that with the atmosphere that she was able to create throughout the entire book of foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
There's a gentle August breeze at the Lady Day celebration at the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And then there's this queer breeze that comes up the night before they sail, and they don't sail that evening because Lillian, Patty's wife, is so upset. Mm-hmm. And then there's the big storm, you know, so you have this, you know, progression of the use of the breeze throughout the book and the wind.
I think Barbara's handling of those visions, and they call them tokens in the book, and was interesting because she didn't say that, you know, Father McGinnigan, is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know. I didn't have to pronounce it.
You know, she didn't say he said that he saw these things. You know, it was very factual. Every vision that everybody had was, you know, it was, she didn't question it whatsoever, and I think it was interesting. It was very well done, they all stick in my head. You know, the whole crew of the boat outside of Father McGinnigan's house, you know, when he hears a knock on the door and opens the door, and there's the whole crew, and then they just evaporate. And it was
very good. Haunting.
Yeah,
James standing by Lucy's bed when she's just given birth to his daughter, you know, and then she knows he's no longer there.
Mm-hmm. And what do you guys think about the switched bodies? I mean, as if the story's not outrageous enough.
That was just amazing. You certainly understand how that can happen. I mean, they had a certain physical resemblance in general, but the misidentification at the beginning was rather startling. But the whole idea that you'd get all through the wake and actually get the body into the ground, it's, you know, Emperor's New Clothes all over, I guess, in some ways. You know, somebody should have said something.
Well, I think it also points to the social differences between the lace curtain Irish and the shanty Irish.
Absolutely.
They couldn't upset the boat, and how much power the priest had in the community.
Right. So the adults were afraid to upset the priest. Mm-hmm. And the children were afraid to upset their mother. And then their mother got angry with them for not saying something. So, oh my God, they couldn't win.
I think from a writerly perspective, it was well handled, too, in that the narrator bounced from head to head. And, you know, you'd be in the kid's head saying, oh, that's not my dad. And then it was in the wife's head.
And yes, it was. So we have just a couple minutes. And since, John, we have you here, tell us about Of Sea and Cloud. Tell us about your novel.
Well, it's a novel set in Washington County, a kind of fictionalized version of Washington County. It's the story of mostly of two sons whose father is lost at sea, and it's them dealing with the after effect of their father's death and kind of a struggle for, not so much topically a struggle for a lobster in territory, but that's the backdrop for the novel. And yeah, it's just them dealing with, you know, their father owned a lobster pound, and so they're negotiating ownership of this pound, and just their world as they know it is kind of coming down around them. And it's also set during the time there's a collapse in the global fisheries are kind of collapsing at the same time, and the lobster price has really plunged. And so they're in this really isolated community trying to just navigate life while this small isolated community kind of butts heads with a global economy.
So some parallels.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Yep.
And how did you get the idea for it?
Well, I was working on a lobster boat for a couple of years and working winters at this lobster pound. And it's a real, you know, a cove. It's not a restaurant lobster pound. It's a tidal cove lobster storage facility. Mm. And I'd take notes from stuff I'd hear on the boat radios, or I'd hear these guys say. I just kept writing down notes and more, and I really was hesitant to write about it because maybe Barbara felt some of the same thing about Newfoundland, because I wasn't from there. You know, I'm not a down east local, and I didn't grow up working on boats, and I just moved there and got a job on a boat. So it took me a couple of years of working on a boat before I felt comfortable in writing about that culture. Mm. And I just had all these notes, and I just kept starting to write, and I'm like, no, I can't do that. And
so you didn't move there intending to write a novel, but
no,
living there and just letting your imagination go with what you were living every day, sort of one thing led to another.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to work on a lobster boat, and I did. But it was just unbelievable. You know, there's the stuff these guys are saying. You know, I could not write it down.
So, I like that. Well, thank you all three for being here today. I know you all traveled a bit of a distance to join us, and we do appreciate it. Linda Oliver is head of reference at the Bangor Public Library. Ruth Eveland is director of the Jessup Memorial Library in Bangor. And John Keller, the author, as we just mentioned, of the new novel of Sea and Cloud. Next month, our book club turns to a work of fiction. We will be discussing Elizabeth Strout's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Olive Kittredge, which is also being made into an HBO movie. Set in Maine, it tells the story of Olive, her husband, and the joys, surprises, and heartaches of everyday life. Please join us for our next book club meeting, September 25th, when we will discuss Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout. John Keimel ran the board today. Our intern, Graham Morgan, answered your calls. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.